Welcome to Truth Hub with your host, Daniel Minnick, viewing the world through the Word.
Hello, welcome back again to the Truth Hub podcast. This is your host, Daniel Minnick, and I must say that it has been quite a hiatus since the last time we did an episode. It's been at least over a year, and I would like to point out two major things that have happened, that have transpired since the last episode. One of them is totally understandable, totally expected, and another one is rather surprising. The one thing that is surprising is the fact that the Denver Broncos won Super Bowl number 50. That is very surprising to me. The one other major thing that was not that is totally surprising, or rather not surprising, sorry, is the fact that we have a known criminal running for President of the United States, has the nomination for President of the United States, has been found guilty by the FBI, but basically the charges are dismissed. And part of that also is the fact that her opponent is also one of her biggest donors. So I guess we're kind of in a little bit of a trouble unless God works a miracle out in the United States, but just like to point out things that transpired since the last episode. For this episode of the Truth Hub podcast, we are in for a real treat today. We are going to discuss the topic of Jehovah's Witnesses, and particularly, how do we dialogue with Jehovah's Witnesses, and more specifically, how do we witness to them? Because they like to talk in a certain language and use certain terms that you have to understand when they come to your door. And we must remember that they are a mission field for us. And if we're going to be Christians, we have to obey 1 Peter 3:15, which is our apologetic verse. And that tells us to be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a hope, asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you, but to do that with meekness and fear. And so I have a special guest with me that we're going to talk about his particular encounter with Jehovah's Witnesses. And so my guest today is my brother, John Minnick. And before we get to that, I'm going to say that I didn't have my brother as a guest in the program just because he's my brother, but because of the subject matter today. And so, here to discuss a particular interview and an encounter that he had with Jehovah's Witnesses is my brother, John. John, how are you doing today?
Doing all right, Daniel.
Okay, so what do you have for us as far as an introduction as to this particular encounter?
Well, it seemed like just about any other day. It was a Saturday, and it was August 1st of 2015, around 1:30 p.m., I was in my apartment, and then I heard a knock at the door.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, a knock at the door. Well, it could be anyone. It could be a salesman, but anyways. So when I answered it, I saw a young man, probably in his early 20s, wearing a white dress shirt. He may have been wearing a black tie, khaki pants, black dress shoes. He had neatly combed blonde hair.
Sounds like a Mormon to me, but no. I digress.
Yeah. Sometimes these groups can look the same, but he was probably about 6 feet tall, maybe. He looked kind of taller than I was, but not much. He had a purple Bible under his right arm and a tract in his hand.
So the purple Bible is affectionately known as the Purple People Eater. I know there's a fictional character called the Purple People Eater, and so some people, like I've heard Gene Cook Jr. refer to that as the Purple People Eater, but okay.
Yeah, anyways, he told me that Jesus was our Savior, but that he was not just a Savior, but also a conqueror.
Of course, we agree with that, but
yeah, so that's what perked my interest. He asked me if I knew who Jesus was, because his looks reminded me of college friends at Pensacola Christian College. I assumed that he was an Orthodox Christian who was sharing the gospel in an invitation ministry. I was happy that he visited me. I told him that I was a born-again Christian who believed in Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. He told me that was great and started describing the play that he was inviting me to that was on his tract. While he was talking to me, I looked at the tract to notice that it said Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses at the bottom. So at that moment, I felt panic and excitement knowing that I had the opportunity to talk to a Jehovah's Witness after having listened to some of James White's lectures on the Trinity and Jehovah's Witnesses and his debate with Greg Stafford, who was a Jehovah's Witness at the time.
So in that particular situation, what do you think is the most common response that people, like in your situation, do when they find out that it's a Jehovah's Witness at the door?
Yeah. Well, seeing how this is my first encounter, I'm not sure if I can relate to the typical person, but I've heard that the typical person is usually not ready to talk to them. And fortunately for me, this was 1:30 p.m., but I've heard a lot of stories that this is earlier on, like in the morning when people are sleeping and they're not ready to talk to them, so they just tell them, I'm a Christian, and then close the door on them.
Yeah, because who wants to have a deep theological discussion with someone when you have a net in your hair or, you know, a curling iron or something like that? But yeah. No, not that you would wear a net in your hair or a curling iron, but you get the point, right?
Yeah, so I was well rested at this point and ready to talk. So I was not sure how prepared he would be in debating with Orthodox Christians or how ready I would be. I mean, Jehovah's Witnesses, we always assume they're all like very well trained, but that might not necessarily be the case. Some of them might be just starting their field ministry for the first time anyways. So I had never debated anyone before, and I thought that I would panic and not remember any of the scripture references that I had memorized.
That's a reasonable fear. You know, it takes a lot of reading, rereading, memorization. And even when you have something memorized, sometimes, you know, when you're put on the spot, you can easily forget things. We can all relate to that, but it's nothing to feel guilty about, but we always do our best.
Yeah, so I wasn't sure how to start, so I just pointed at the track and I nervously muttered, So, this is from the Jehovah's Witnesses? And he seemed as if he were taken back that I would have a problem with that. And he nervously replied, yes, so?
Yeah, because we probably forget sometimes, we think that Jehovah's Witnesses almost zero in on, you know, Christian homes. We always think of it's the Jehovah's Witnesses versus the Orthodox or Evangelical Christians, but I would think that a big percentage of the people they encounter are actually atheists who don't even know much about them, and so they're, you know, they don't, sometimes, you know, they don't give themselves the credit they deserve for the kind of exposure they get, or they're not aware that a lot of people know about them.
Yeah, and they probably think if I were like an atheist or maybe some very nominal Christian, like they'd think, Jehovah's Witnesses are Christians as well. We're all just the followers of Jesus. We're just kind of a little different, but why would that be a problem? Like, I mean, that's kind of what I would have seen and how his reaction would have been to me. But anyways, at that point, I was not sure how to fix the awkwardness of the moment. So all I could do was do a quick prayer to God at that moment, asking him if he can give me the words to say to talk to the guy. And all of a sudden, I remembered what James White would usually say to break the ice with Jehovah's Witnesses. So I changed the words that he usually said. I asked the guy, would it be okay if I could explain to you what I think you believe, and then you could correct me where I am wrong? And he replied, sure.
Yeah, and just to point out, it's always good, you know, if you're trying to have a conversation with someone, to break the ice, you want to show them that you are interested in what they believe, because they're not going to, you know, stay there if you're going to try to preach at them. So, you know, give them the space to speak. And if we're afraid to do that, then we need to study up on what we believe first. Because, you know, if you really want to have a dialogue with someone, that person has to know that you're interested in what they have to say. And so if they know that you're interested in what they have to say, then they you can get them interested in what you have to say. But
yeah, exactly. So I felt relieved at the moment that I could freely express my knowledge of his faith that could impress him and bring up the subjects to discuss. I said, you believe that in the beginning Jehovah God created Michael the archangel, and then through Michael he created all other things, which is why in your New World Translation, in the verse in Colossians 1:16, it says, for by him were all other things created, where the word other is in brackets. He smiled, he pointed at me and said, ah, you're informed.
So did he just run away after that, or did he continue the dialogue?
Well, he seemed actually interested in talking to me. I tried not to word it in an arrogant manner. I wanted to word it in a very innocent way that I'm interested in talking to him, just so I don't scare him away as if I'm like a former Jehovah's Witness. But so anyway, since he replied positively like that, so I laughed and I continued, you believe that Michael the archangel was recreated as Jesus, and that Jesus died on a torture stake instead of a cross, because in your view a cross is a pagan symbol that was adapted into Orthodox Christianity by mistake.
So I'll point out, with the idea of the torture stake, Jehovah's Witnesses, at least the governing body, they like to find things that can distinguish their religion from Orthodoxy, what evangelical Christians and even Catholics and so on are used to, so they can use that distinguishing factor as a hammer to hit on the nail and say to the people they talk with and show them, well, look, you're wrong about this. And if they can convince you that you're wrong about some minor little thing, then they can make you ask the question, well, what else am I wrong about? And they can say, well, I'm glad you asked. We have some more answers for you.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of cults and seem to have something against the cross. Like, they have a torture stake, but in even Mormonism, they don't like to talk about the cross, at least not in the way Orthodox Christians are. They'll even mock you if you wear a cross necklace or anything. Like, if Jesus died on an electric chair, would you wear an electric chair around your neck? But anyways, back to the subject. So he replied, we can talk about the cross being a pagan symbol later, but could I show you in the Bible who Jesus actually is? And I replied, sure, and I already knew where he was going. So anyways, he opened his purple New World Translation and said, okay, if we turn to the book of John, chapter 1, and verse 1,
uh-oh,
yeah, that's what I thought. It says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God. So as we can see here, Jesus is a God, but he's not the God. Do you have any input on that?
Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses will often start their conversation talking about John 1:1. It's one of their fortes, and they have a mistranslation of that verse in the New World Translation, where in the Greek there is no definite article, and our English translations like will say that the Word was God, and the Jehovah's Witnesses will dispute that and say, well, there's no definite article in the Greek, and so they insert the rule that if there's no definite article, you're free to interpret that indefinitely. So they'll put a God, you know, because it's in the Greek, you know, there's the idea that it has to say the God, otherwise it means a God. But in the Greek, if there's no definite article, it can be qualitative, not quantitative or specific. Like, for instance, one of the verses in John chapter 1, It does not have a definite article, and it says there is a man sent from God whose name was John. And it's the from God or of God is theou. It's in the genitive case, but there's no ton in there. There's no definite article there. So if the Jehovah's Witnesses were correct, we would read that as there was a man sent from a God whose name was a John. And so we know that that rule does not hold up. And, of course, I know that they have answers for that as to why there's something special about John 1:1c. But to continue talking about John 1:1 and why they're also wrong, to understand their perspective that there is a God who was Michael the Archangel, who later became Jesus of Nazareth, who was a creature. In the beginning, the first clause, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was there. Ain is the imperfect form of I, me. That means that in the beginning was being the Word. The Word was already existing and is as far back as you'd like to push that beginning, the Word was being. And so that shows that the Word was not created at the beginning, but in the beginning means the beginning of time. So the Word existed before the creation, before time. He was being. The second clause, and the Word was with God, so that that refutes the modalist because proston theon, with or face-to-face with the God, the Word existed alongside of him. The Word was not just a manifestation of God or an attribute of God. It was there with God, face-to-face with God. And then the third clause, the Word was God. Now, there's no definite article for sure, but the lexical order, you could read it and says God was the Word. Now, there's a reason that most translations would not render it in that order, because the order of words in the Greek language, and now I'm not a Greek expert, but this is all secondhand information, but the word for theos there, is, theos ein halagos, God was the Word. Theos is what is known as a pre-verbal and arthrous predicate nominative. And in other words, if I were to say Daniel was or is a cool guy, and of course we all know that, but guy there, you know, is a predicate nominative. It's on the other side of the, you know, a being verb is. Daniel is the subject, is the linking verb, and guy would be the predicate nominative. But in the Greek language, you could have what is called a pre-verbal predicate nominative. In other words, the subject of the sentence is on the right side of the verb, and then the predicate nominative is on the left side, which you don't have that concept in Greek, or in English, unless you're dealing with like some form of poetic language. But so it's theos there is the word for God is pre-verbal. It's also an arthrous, as we said before. There's no article there. So a fancy way of saying that a noun has no article, like the or a, means it's an arthrous, no article. And that it's a predicate nominative. So in this case, where theos is without an article and is a predicate nominative for the Word, it's describing the nature of the Word. So it's saying the Word was his nature God. You know, it was the quality of God. He was divine. And so you can argue that with the Jehovah's Witnesses and say that just because there's no definite article, it is not ontologically distinct from the God. He is God, you know, he is with the God, and he is also just as much divine as the God.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at the time I wasn't too familiar with all that, and I forgot about the pre-verbal and arthrous predicate nominative.
But that's okay, because it's, you know, usually best not to jump into John 1:1 with a Jehovah's Witness, because they've studied it a lot. They might have answers to that, even though they might be the most ridiculous, illogical answers they can give. It's best to get to John 1:1 later on in the conversation, if at all. But, you know, there are answers to refute their claims that they would translate John 1:1c as the Word was a God.
Yeah, unfortunately for me, the Jehovah's Witnesses that I talked to weren't that familiar with Greek or with how John 1:1 is translated in their New World Translation. So the only way I could think of responding to that quote was to quote John 1:1 in Greek that James White would often do to explain how it cannot say a God grammatically. So I replied, "En arche ein hologos kai hologos en proston theon kai theos ein hologos." He said, "What language is that, Latin?" I replied, "No, that is John 1:1 in Greek."
And you were probably expecting him to know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I was surprised that he thought it was Latin. So I said, "Notice the last phrase, kai theos ein hologos." The words
are logos in the Erasmian pronunciation.
Okay. Yeah. So the words are actually ordered as "and God was the Word" for emphasis, like you had mentioned, but they are conjugated as "and the Word was God." Theos cannot have any article next to it because it is not conjugated for it.
And to mention that if he said "and the Word was the God," as they're expecting, by saying that the Word was face to face or with God, and you know, if you were to say "kai theos ein halagos," "kai ha theos ein halagos," that would, in the Greek language, that would make the Word equal to the God in such a way that the God would equal the Word, and that would be support modalism, which we know that the Scriptures don't. So there is a good reason why we don't want a definite article there.
Yeah. Okay. So he replied, "Okay, so did you know that God has a name?" Now, I already heard some apologists talk about how Jehovah's Witnesses love to show that they know the divine name of God. So,
and that concept comes from the sacred name movement. If anyone knows anything about where Jehovah's Witnesses come from, that would be a topic for another episode. But briefly, there was a guy named William Miller in the 1800s. He made a prediction that Jesus would return based on Daniel chapters 7 through 9, that Jesus would return on October 22nd, 1844. There was a great disappointment on that day when he didn't show up, and then there were splits, and the prediction moved forward until several dates until 1914, and then the group that basically emerged from that believed that Jesus still had to return in the future visibly became the Adventists. And then the group that believed that Jesus did return invisibly or spiritually in some way and the end times were ushered in, like the clock started ticking again, were what became known as the Jehovah's Witnesses. But that's a little trivia for you to do some more research.
Yeah, so when his question was, "Do you know that God has a name?" And then I replied, "God has many names in the Bible, but I know the name that you are thinking of, Jehovah." He replied, "Exactly. Do you know where the name Jehovah comes from?" And, of course, I might be wrong on some of this, but this is what I knew at the time. I replied, "I'm not exactly sure, but I think it is a German pronunciation of Yehovah, which comes from the Hebrew tetragrammaton Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, with the added vowels from the word Adonai, which is the word for Lord."
Yeah, that's roughly correct. I'd say Germanic, you know, not modern German, but a Germanic misapplication or mispronunciation of, yeah, it's the tetragrammaton with the, you know, in written Hebrew before the Masoretes, there was no written vowels. There was just the consonants, so you had Yod, Heh, Vav, Heh. And then to avoid pronouncing the name when writing, or basically, yes, to avoid pronouncing the divine name, they would take the vowels from the word for Adonai and insert them in there and then pronounce that. And then that became slaughtered in Germanic, in a Germanic language as Yehovah or Jehovah.
Having a hard time studying the Bible.
Dude, those genealogies really get me.
Want to have your Bible and the latest scholarly research all at the tip of your fingers?
Yeah, dude.
Then Kitchen Sink Productions has the perfect tool for you.
Is this like another eSword or Bible Works or Olive Tree app for my smartphone?
No, it's the Kitchen Sink Interlinear Bible.
Huh?
Yes, never leave your home without it. The Kitchen Sink Interlinear Bible comes equipped with 100 English Bible translations, 50 foreign languages, 8 commentaries, Strong's Concordance, and Greek and Hebrew texts and lexicons, all in a neat and tidy interlinear format.
The Kitchen Sink Interlinear Bible is my ultimate resource for Bible study. I can't believe they packed so much into one 80-pound volume. The only problem is that I need my reading glasses to read the 4-point font.
With the Kitchen Sink Interlinear Bible, you will have everything you need to handle the toughest challenges from the world.
You know them JWs that come knocking on my door on Saturday mornings are tough cookies, but I'll be ready for them next time. I got my Kitchen Sink Interlinear sitting on my bookshelf. When they show up, I'll be able to argue John 1:1 with them and prove that Jesus is God from the Hittite in Sanskrit. I'll blow them away with my 150 Bible canon salute. Thanks, Kitchen Sink.
And the Kitchen Sink Interlinear color codes each translation so that they are easier to find.
It's a rainbow of fun, huh?
So, order your Kitchen Sink Interlinear Bible today for just 5 easy payments of $99.95.
No CODs. This product is not sold in stores. May require a credit check or other financial verification. Not to replace regular fitness program. Consult your doctor or chiropractic if back or neck pain occurs within the first 48 hours of use. Discontinue use if chronic cough or bleeding begins. Other restrictions may apply. Some assembly required. Batteries not included.
Is your church looking for a new pastor?
Boy, I'll say.
Are you searching for that perfect Bible scholar to take the podium and lead God's flock to the next step?
No more slimy standards. Just give me Jesus.
Then your wait is over.
Over. Over. Over.
Whoa.
Introducing the new RoboPastor 3000, a breakthrough turnkey solution from Kitchen Sink Electronics for the struggling church of the 21st century.
Hi, I am Pastor. Please give me a name. Welcome to Please Record Your Church. We're glad you're here today.
Wow, he's so handsome.
Yes, no more overweight, unsightly pastors making your church look bad. The RoboPastor 3000 is slim and trim and comes with interchangeable wigs in 5 separate colors and 20 different styles so your new pastor can look hip and relevant wherever your church is located.
Our last pastor retired early and we needed a new pastor bad. I found the RoboPastor 3000 on eBay and knew that he was God's will for our little church. No more extra long sermons, sabbaticals, or sick days. It's a dream come true. We just had to budget a little more for electricity.
No more hours in the office studying for sermons. The RoboPastor 3000 has the whole Bible memorized in 250 English translations and 120 foreign languages, including the original Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic.
Wow, he's like so smart.
And for the crusty old fogies in your church who want to pretend that it is still the year 1853, the RoboPastor 3000 comes complete with sermon collections from Spurgeon, Wesley, Whitfield, and Edwards.
Not quite the same with this newfangled contraption, but I'll take it.
The RoboPastor 3000 comes included with licenses to marry and perform funerals. He can also sing like Caruso, dance like Elvis, and host church parties that will be sure to draw a harvest of souls into your church.
I like our new pastor.
Yeah, he's like so dreamy.
And if you act now, we'll include the RoboPastor's Wife 3000 for free.
What?
The RoboPastor's Wife 3000 can cook, sing, teach women's devotionals, and organize church movie nights and concerts.
It's nice to have another woman in the church who understands my taste in men and decorating.
So, don't let the 21st century slip by your church. Get your RoboPastor 3000 and RoboPastor's Wife 3000 today for just $99.99.95. No minimum deposit. Consult a doctor and a lawyer before use. Side effects may include nausea, vomiting, or indigestion. Keep away from fire. Do not attempt to assemble if smoking or pregnant. Add $99.95 for shipping and handling. Other restrictions may apply. Some assembly required. Batteries not included.
You are listening to the Truth Hub Podcast with Daniel Minnick.
And welcome back to Truth Hub. We are interviewing John Minnick about a encounter he had with Jehovah's Witnesses.
So then he scowled at me and he replied, "Okay, that's interesting, but I am familiar with the Tetragrammaton." And then he said, "So, could I explain to you why Jesus died on a torture stake instead of a cross?" And then I replied, "Sure." So then he went on to explain that on a torture stake, one has less strength to pull himself up to breathe. But while hanging on a cross with his arms outstretched, a person would die slowly over about 3 days. He said that on a torture stake, one would die within about 3 to 6 hours, which is how Jesus did. And at the time, I kind of wish I remembered to point out that soldiers went to each of the subjects to smash their knees so that they could no longer push themselves up to breathe. But Jesus already died because he gave his life rather than having it taken from him so that none of his bones were broken.
Yeah, there's a prophecy there, and there's a significance to the prophecy about none of his bones being broken. In other words, there was something supernatural in the fact that he would die a gruesome death, yet he gave his life, as he said in John chapter 10, that no one takes my life from me, I give it of my own accord, and that, you know, he didn't just die naturally because of the death. You know, he said he gave his life, and Roman crucifixion wasn't just hang, you know, nail them there until they breathe their last breath and then you take their body down. No, it was intended to be a very painful experience. You didn't get relief from pain by, you know, expiring yourself. They would, you know, you would hang there and you would struggle to breathe, you know, hopelessly, because, you know, eventually, you know, you're stuck there. You can't come down. I mean, Jesus, you know, would have had the power to come down from the cross, and people mocked him and said, "If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." But Roman crucifixion was, you know, you're condemned to die for a day because they had to put other people up on those stakes with the cross beams, of course, and with their arms stretched out so that they would continue struggling for breath until the even, when the shift was over, and then the soldiers would break their legs so that then they couldn't push themselves up to breathe, and then they would die from suffocation.
Yeah, and so, like, the soldiers were not trying to make sure everyone died naturally, like as in the torture stake, at least in this sense anyways, with Jesus, but they could allow the criminals to suffer, but then put them to death when they had to. But anyways, I wish I would have thought about that and to give him as an argument, but I didn't have an argument for him at the time. So I remember Jesus commanding his disciples to take up their cross and follow him. I was curious about how such passages were rendered in the New World Translation. I looked them up in my sword app on my phone, and then first I asked him to read Matthew 16:24. So he read, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'If anyone wants to come after me, let him disown himself and pick up his torture stake and keep following me.' I found it difficult not to laugh at the command for someone to pick up his torture stake." So then I asked him to read Mark 8:34. He read, "He now called the crowd to him with his disciples and said to him, 'If anyone wants to come after me, let him disown himself and pick up his torture stake and keep following me.' While I was trying not to smirk at the sound of torture stake, I asked him to finally read Luke 9:23. He read, "Then he went on to say to all, 'If anyone wants to come after me, let him disown himself and pick up his torture stake day after day and keep following me.' At that point, I could not help but smirk because he was reading the verses seriously and didn't seem to get what I was driving at. And then I finally said, 'Sorry, it just sounds funny to me to hear torture stake instead of cross in those verses.'
And, you know, who knows that this person could have been, like, converted from atheism. He could have grown up as a Jehovah's Witness. You know, sometimes we think a Jehovah's Witness is usually a convert from a weak Christian. So he's used to dealing with, you know, conventional evangelical Christian wisdom. But, you know, he might, you know, he's taught that, you know, Christians will use the cross, but he's, you know, he's probably not used to expecting and dealing with that concept of torture stake versus cross. But
yeah. So then I added another thing here. One thing that you believe differently than I do is about the resurrection of Jesus. Do you believe that Jesus was resurrected in his body, or was he recreated again? So then he said, Jesus came back as in a new body. It was a new body, but it was a glorified body. So then I said, I agree, but it was also the same body that he died in. And then he said, not necessarily. If Jesus came back in the same body, that would diminish the value of what he did by dying for us. And then I immediately defended and said, or by his coming back to life in the same body that he died in, he demonstrates his victory over sin and death. So then he says, okay, let me show you from the Bible how Jesus could not have come back in a normal physical human body.
This will be interesting.
Yeah, so he brings up Luke 24:36, and then he says something like, while they were speaking on these things, he himself stood in their midst and said to them, may you have peace. And then he said, see, after Jesus came back in his glorified body, he appeared in their midst. So we see that Jesus had the ability to appear and disappear. Can a human body do that? So then I was...
That's pretty interesting that, you know, okay, like the scriptures that say that, you know, when he shall appear, you know, at the second coming, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And if it's, you know, I believe it's 1 Corinthians 15 where it talks about that which is sown in the ground, you know, is earthly, and that which is comes back out of the ground is heavenly. But, you know, if it's the glorified body, you know, it should still be a body, but the way they argue, it sounds like they're talking about like a spirit creature. So, you know, how can you call it a resurrection if, you know, if something is sown into the ground and what comes out of that, you know, like a seed is sown in the ground, it sprouts out and becomes a tree, you know, it becomes a lot more glorious than what it was as a seed. But, you know, the tree comes from the seed. The seed doesn't just, you know, yes, the seed in a sense dies, and then the life comes from that, but it's still the same thing. You know, it's just glorified. But, you know, in their view, they have Michael the Archangel basically disappearing, and then the person Jesus of Nazareth is conceived in the womb of Mary. You know, it's a new creature. It's not the same person. And then when, you know, Jesus of Nazareth, you know, is resurrected, it's basically Michael the Archangel again. It's yet again Michael recreated, not even the same Michael the Archangel as before, but a new Michael the Archangel, and not really Jesus of Nazareth. And it's like a spirit creature, which, you know, I struggle to understand how they can call that a resurrection. But
yeah, and I always thought, why do they have to get rid of Michael the Archangel to make Jesus? I mean, what was the whole point of that? And I always wondered, what is the role of Michael the Archangel if for like 33 and a half years we don't even need him? Whatever, but that's going off topic anyways. So I was tempted when he asked me, like, does a physical human body have the ability to do that? I was tempted to tell him that his question reeks of Gnosticism, but I refrained. So I just told him that God can do whatever he wants, including allowing a human body to appear and disappear. Besides, you know, in that same passage in Luke 24, Jesus asked for food and he ate in their presence. So, I mean, if it's a spirit, wouldn't the food kind of fall on the floor or something? But
yeah, I know. Well, the spirit can just pretend to digest it and, you know, disintegrate it into to air. But, you know, what's the point of him showing that he's risen from the dead and he eats just like they do? He eats with them to prove a point, doesn't he?
Yeah. And also when Jesus said, like, does the spirit have flesh and bones as you see me have? So then I was surprised by his response. He said, as you see me have, as if the word see is the emphasis rather than the flesh and bones.
So in other words, was Jesus lying? You know, yeah. Was he being deceptive? Did he ask them, you know, like, because... Is he inventing a new class of creatures? Like, okay, I'm not the kind of spirit that you expected because spirits don't have flesh and bones, but my new spirit-body has flesh and bones that are not really flesh and bones, and it just looks like it as, you know, as it's manifest. And, you know, what's interesting is, I don't know if you encountered this in your dialogue with him, but it's interesting that he tells doubting Thomas when he's doubting that Jesus is risen from the dead. What's the empirical proof that he rose from the dead? Not that he's just some spirit walking around, but that he has, you know, wounds, you know, from the crucifixion. He says, you know, stick your fingers into my hands and thrust your hand into my side and be not faithless, but, you know, have faith, but believing. And then when Thomas does that, then Thomas says, you know, my Lord and my God, which of course is further discussion with Jehovah's Witnesses on that. But, you know, he has wounds. You know, what's the point of his wounds if it's entirely different, created from scratch body? Why are there wounds if the point of the so-called resurrected Jesus as the new Michael the Archangel is that it's a new being? You know, is it deception for him to have wounds in this new spirit body that they call a glorified body when it's not, because it's not really a body in what they really mean by that? It's just as much a body as, you know, the angels of heaven.
Yeah, and it kind of sounds like as if Jesus or God is trying to make us all believe that he actually rose from the dead the way us Orthodox Christians believe, but then yet they're going to say, oh, you're so dumb for believing that. Well, what is God trying to do? Is he trying to deceive us, and then we have to piece the puzzle together to figure out, well, that's not what really happened, but he made it look that way?
Yeah, to further point out, the Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 17, in his sermon on Mars Hill, he talks to the Greeks about, you know, the resurrection of Jesus, and then they mock him, and, you know, because in Greek belief at the time, the idea was, you know, of course, in Gnosticism, that the salvation is to escape the body. You know, they believe that most people, you know, who weren't privileged by the pantheon, the Greek gods, would go to a place called Hades. It would be their, you know, disembodied soul, and then they would wander around in Hades in doom and gloom in a way, and then eventually they might, like, fade out of existence, and, you know, that would be final deliverance for them from the gloom of Hades, and those who were privileged would go to the Elysian fields. But, you know, they mocked Paul's message about Jesus' resurrection because to them it's like, why would, you know, the body that you escape from be the one that, you know, you desire to have again? And, you know, you'd think the Apostle Paul could have just told them, no, guys, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm talking about getting an entirely new body that's totally disconnected from the old one. But they just mocked him. They obviously understood what he's saying, and he's proclaiming that Jesus rose in the body that he had, and that's what we will see at the last day, the day of judgment. We will be resurrected in a glorified body, but it is the body that was sown into the ground, reconstructed, perfected, but the same body.
Yeah, exactly. So then all of a sudden he said, like, he asked me, so are you familiar with Armageddon?
Uh-oh.
Here it comes.
Yeah, you could have said, yeah, like, a, you know, maybe, I don't know if you've seen the what's that movie?
Independence.
Yeah, Independence Day, that's what I was thinking of, you know, like, you could have said that, but I don't think that's what they were talking about.
Yeah, so he says, like, are you familiar with Armageddon? Do you know what that is or what it entails? So then I replied, I'm not exactly sure what Armageddon is. I think that it is a battle that will occur in the last days before the new heavens and new earth are created. I'm not sure how it all works, I think I have an idea about your view of Armageddon. In your view, is Armageddon a time where Michael the Archangel will either cause natural disasters or literally hurl fireballs down onto the earth to destroy all the corrupt governments and everyone else except for the faithful Jehovah's Witnesses? And then he kind of chuckled and said something like, well, the details are not very clear, but that is a pretty good guess.
Well, John, that's all the time we have for this episode. We will continue this discussion about your interview with Jehovah's Witnesses next time on the Truth Hub Podcast.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Truth Hub Podcast. Look for more episodes to strengthen your faith as we continue to view the world through the Word right here at truthhub.org.